welcome to everybody that's joined us since we first started, and a particular welcome to any newcomers or visitors to the meeting this evening. And we hope you hear something that encourages you to want to keep coming back to Narcotics Anonymous. So yeah, we are a speaker meeting tonight, and it gives me real pleasure to introduce our speaker. This is someone I've known for 10 years doing service. We met actually doing service online through a different kind of meeting. And we've become real friends, and she's a part of my life, and I'm a part of hers. And yeah, she has an interesting story to share. So I'm going to, without any further ado, hand you over to Debs. So Debs, please share with us.
Hi guys, my name's Debs, and I'm a grateful recovering addict.
Hey Debs.
Hi Debs.
I just trapped my fingers in his bloody chair. That's a good start, isn't it? Now then, where do I start? Well, at the beginning, you see, I got here this morning full of enthusiasm to see Steve, who, like he says, I've known for a long time now, and we've been through a lot together. And he said, you know, we're gonna wire up the meeting tonight, doing an online meeting. I went, that's great. And he says, you know, it's a speaker meeting. I said, that's even better. Who's doing the share? He said, you are. And I thought, shit, I have been nobbled big time and spectacularly, because I've just clocked up 11 and a half years clean. And in that time, I've managed to swerve quite successfully, bearing my all, as they say, and doing a big online share. And I guess, you know, one day I was going to be had, and today is that day. And so I've tried not to think about it all day, and I've been listening to a lot of people sharing here, and it's, you know, it's great to see. There's a lot of nerves kicking about, and people are sharing. And I think people are incredibly brave, because some of them, you know, they don't have a lot of clean time under their belt, and they get up on that stage and they pour their hearts out. And I have total admiration for those people. But Steve said to me, you know, it's dead simple, really. You just do before, how I got here, how it was in the beginning, how it is now, and what I'm giving back is what I've added to this. So I'll make a start. I am I make no bones about saying this in an NA meeting. I am an alcoholic. That is my drug of choice. And I'm also a farmer. And that becomes more important, I guess, as the story goes along, because it kind of gives an understanding as to why I'm so downright bloody obstinate most of the time. I come from a long line of alcoholics, believe it or not. My grandmother, alcoholism killed her, and she was an absolutely wonderful woman. And I miss her very dearly. And in the mid-70s, she got clean on her own. And you know, she didn't do letters or anything like that. She just stopped drinking. She got clean. And she's been gone a long time now. You know, she died when I was in my 20s. And the more I think about that woman, the more I admire her, because, you know, in the late 70s, early 80s, women just didn't have that type of problem. And if they did, it was swept under the carpet. You know, it was shameful. It was not what happened to decent women. And she was a decent woman. You know, she'd supported my granddad through a war. He signed up at the beginning and came out at the end, thank God. She'd done her fair share of losing children. And she had my dad and his brother, who's about 15 years younger. And, you know, my dad, two different people you couldn't wish to meet. And my dad forms, I guess, sadly now, a fundamental part of why I'm sat here telling you I'm an alcoholic. He still is an incredibly ambitious man, and he's a very old man now. And his work and his life and what he wanted took preference over anything else that was happening in our lives. And subsequently, by the age of 8, I'd moved school about 6 times. I'd had 6 different homes. And the only kind of sanctuary that I really felt was in Leicester, which is where they come from. I wasn't born in Leicester, I was born in Lancashire. And I liked it in Lancashire. I loved it there. And at my grandma's, but I can remember often as a child going into my grandma's and lying, crying on the sofa. And my dad's brother, who's 15 years younger than my dad, he would just sweep us up and say, come on, girls, we're going to go and play in the park. And I could never quite weigh up why. I knew she was ill. I knew something was going on. But at the age of 8, 9, 10, you can't put your finger on it. But I was brought up, you know, I was brought up in a life where we moved around all the time, where I was always the odd child at school. And I became very insular, and I also became very nervous, and I suffered from a lot of anxiety, which is something that I still suffer from now badly at times. And I've got a gorgeous little girl sat next to me. And when I got to kind of, and I was brought up in an environment where people weren't alcoholics. Alcoholics was a dirty word, I guess. And we were all working class family. They were what they called big hitters on the drink, you know, and it was almost a medal that people wore. You know, they'd go out on a Friday night and get absolutely sink some serious drink, and same on Saturday night. You know, as children, we were always in the pub by 12 o'clock on a Sunday lunch. You know, my dad's brother drinks way too much, and my dad, he would argue the toss. He's been a functioning alcoholic for years, a very successfully functioning alcoholic, but nevertheless, he's a functioning alcoholic. But he's one of these people that can decide he's going to quit for 2 weeks, and he quits. So therefore, to him, he doesn't have a problem. But mine, my sister's, and my mum's lives have all been shaped around his work. You know, as children, we didn't see our father all week. And the first place he went when he headed home from wherever he was working to wherever his company had moved us to on a Friday night, he pulled into the pub. He didn't come home and see his wife and kids first, he pulled into the pub. And this whole thing shaped the person that I was to become in my teen years, you know, drinking and spending time in the pub, drinking at home with the family. You know, there's no secret drinking going on at this point. It was all part and parcel of the people that we were. And I also found once, I was somebody back then that looked older than I was. So I never found it difficult when out with friends to go into a pub, and I'm talking 30, 40 years ago now, or 30, 35 years ago, actually, if I'm going to be realistic here. I'm not going to sell my age down the river. And I wasn't one of these people that had any difficulty going into a pub and getting a real drink. You know, I had friends older than me that had to make do for a soft drink, and I was the one that always got the drink. And you know, it tasted good, and it got rid of the anxiety. So that the whole thing, you know, when I've looked back on my life as I've got into recovery, it goes back a lot further than I ever thought it would do. And, you know, and I progressed in life. I got a father that drove my sister and I to be very ambitious. And we were always told we didn't need to get married. We didn't need the man to keep us. Which, you know, I'm going back into the 70s, early 80s. In those days, it was still very much the norm for teenagers in those days from, you know, we were all from working class background. But it was very much the norm that at 20, when you got married, then you had kids, you know. It was a pretty much of a horror story back then, and you know, those of you my age or older will probably be nodding their heads that you came home pregnant and you hadn't at least got a ring on your bloody finger. You know, shotgun weddings were not unheard of, and of course we got into the 80s and everything changed. And you know, at 22, 23, I wasn't married and I was pursuing a career, and I studied agriculture. That's all I ever wanted to do. And my dad wanted me to go into the textile industry, which is what his game was, and we had some big rails about that. My mother wanted me to be a secretary, and we had some big rails about that because all her friends' daughters were secretaries, and it was the nice thing for girls to do. So very much in that sort of ilk that I was brought up in, and I something inside me maybe 13 said I want to be a farmer, and it's something that is in my family. Excuse me. It's, you know, historically, they both sides of the family, we from farming stock. So it's in the blood, as they say. And I left school I left school with some decent qualifications, much to their surprise and mine. And I went off and milked cows for a living, and I absolutely bloody loved it. And, you know, I got in with the farming crowd, and, you know, the drinking carried on. And I suffer as some of you know, with quite a bad back. And it kind of got to a stage, without talking to every bloody year of my life, that I couldn't really carry on milking and doing the manual farming work, which is something that I, you know, it's always bothered me because my back was killing me. I got thrown off a bloody horse as well, which was not really a great thing to do, and that made matters worse. So I went to agricultural college and I did my qualifications in agriculture, and someone said, you know, you really can't carry on as you are. Why don't you do a farm secretarial course? So I did all that, and I kind of really got into computers whilst I was at college. The intranet, for those of you that are older than me, was kind of taking off. And I left college and fully qualified, and I went off and did some work experience in Nottingham, and I worked for a couple of people that used Apple Macs. And I, for one guy, I ran an intranet for Nottingham University, and I really got into this, and I really learned so much of these people. And it, you know, it stood me in marvellous stead, because I kind of leapfrogged off this into a career selling software for farmers. And I moved over to East Anglia, and this software, this fucking stuff sold itself. I became a complete and utter workaholic. I met some really crazy rich people who I'm still great friends with. I was making a lot of money, and when we weren't out selling, I was trading commodities as well. At that point, my career expanded. Self-employed, I was working 18 hours a day. I was living on my own in a two-bed semi. I was probably spending 12 hours a week in there, and I had a fucking cleaner. You know, that's how busy I was. And she washed the pots, did the ironing and that sort of shit, you know, and it's Jesus Christ. But it was absolutely chaos every weekend. Nigh on, we were flying across to Dublin to meet the guys that we were trading potatoes and onions with. It sounds mad. And we were living a champagne lifestyle. And, you know, I knew that my drinking was not what it should be. I was functioning. I was hitting really big sales targets. I was weighed about 8.5 stone, piss wet through, and I'm 5 foot, well, I'm shrinking a bit now, but I was 5'7". So, you know, it wasn't great. I wasn't feeling good. But, you know, I was on a roll, and the software was on a roll, and I was making bloody good money. But I knew I'd got a problem, because on the nights of the week that we didn't go out, I was sat at home doing paperwork from...
Okay, guys, yeah, I'm sorry about that. We're actually in the hotel, so we're kind of stuck with the hotel Wi-Fi, but, I mean, we'll do our best, okay?
Sorry. Okay, so I've completely forgotten where I was now. Yeah, I was drinking a lot at home, and I just knew that something had to change and something had to give. And some friends of mine bought a pub in Cumbria, and I went up for the weekend, and... I met the guy that I'm with and still with, and I decided to give up my life down south and move up there, and it was such a dramatic contrast that for a while I was still getting up at 4 in the morning and driving. I got towards the A1 one morning about 4:30 in the morning, and I didn't feel very well. I just didn't feel good at all. And I got on at Scotch Corner, anyone in the UK will know where that is, and they were doing all these roadworks, and I got into these cones, and I actually thought I was having a freaking heart attack. And I managed to pull off at Catterick Garrison, and the guys there were incredible, and they got the Garrison doctor out to me and had a look at me, and he said, you're having a panic attack. Well, I didn't even know what a bloody panic attack was. But anyway, to cut a long story short, we got some friends down and we got me in the car home, and I went to the local doctor who professed to know all there was to know about mental health. And he told me that I was suffering seriously with a burnout mental health issue, and he banged me on a load of pills. And well, these pills about sent me crazy. And the only thing that I could think to do that try and alleviated my pain and suffering was to drink even more, and that's when the whole issue spiraled completely and utterly out of control. And this went on for about 18 months, and you know, my mum and dad were genuinely very worried about me, and I went into rehab for 2 weeks to appease them, really. I hadn't hit my rock bottom, and I read all the right pieces of paper and made all the right noises in rehab. and got out. And I didn't really do that much for me, to be honest, other than one thing. We had to go to meetings as part of our recovery. And my first ever NA meeting I went to was in Nottingham. And I remember walking into this meeting with some of the other girls from recovery. I did an AA meeting and that just didn't work for me at all. But I went to this NA meeting and I just sat there and I thought, wow, these people, hang on a minute, these people are living my life. What the fuck is going on here? And everything that everybody shared was me. And it suddenly made me realise that I wasn't actually alone here, that what I was happening to me was happening to other people as well. I wasn't a freak. I wasn't having a mental breakdown. I didn't need locking up. I just needed to listen to what these people were saying. And when it came to going for white key tags, they'd run out when it got to me. And I remember this guy, and I would love to find this guy, but I doubt I ever will. He'd had his for about 10 years. And he took it off his keyring. It was an old battered thing. I've still got it in a drawer. And he said, here, you can have mine. And that really, really resonated with me. And I went back to the centre. And I said, you know, this NA, yeah, works for me. This is good. I like this. And they got on the internet and they looked and said, oh, shit, tough shit. They said, there's nothing within miles of where you live. And at this point, because I'd had a panic attack, I couldn't drive anywhere. That was mission impossible. And I thought, fuck it. So anyway, I went home and I picked up. And it was as simple as that. And I picked up for a long while. And about 6 months later, my dad announced that he'd got bowel cancer. He went for his bowel cancer op. He went into major organ failure. And he got E. coli, sepsis, C. diff, and MRSA. And I stood watching, you know, I've been in the room with the vicar and the teapot, with my mother and my sister and his brother, because that's all he's got. And I've done that four times. I sat watching a man battling for his very survival in a coma. You couldn't get near him for wires. And he's still with us. And I couldn't weigh up at that time. To me then, God had gone. Fuck you. This is shit. Anything I'd ever believed in, I don't believe in anymore. And I couldn't understand why he, fighting what he was fighting, could do that. And I couldn't put the lid back on a bottle. And I just couldn't do it. But I can remember standing at his bedside in intensive care one day. And we were there all the time. And I'd just lost a baby. I'd lost my third child. I'd buried my godmother, I'd said goodbye to two uncles, and I'd also buried a 28-year-old cousin to brain cancer. And I remember standing there looking at him, thinking, I can't do any more of this. And there was something that reared up inside of me that was so strong, I will never, ever forget it, that just said, you can, and you need to keep going. Now is not the time, but you need to keep going. And this was, Dad was in a coma for about 16 weeks. And we got him home and we had our first family Christmas at home. And I was still using and they knew I was using. They're not stupid people. And we got to sit down at the Christmas dinner table and I didn't feel too well. And I got up. I took my dad off the back of his chair. I cannoned across two radiators and into the hall and I collapsed. My heart stopped and I had a seizure. All I can remember is a paramedic shoving a honking great big needle full of adrenaline into my ass and asking me what I could see. And I can remember seeing my parents sobbing. I woke up a day and a half later in hospital. And they were drying me out, basically. And my sister stood staring at me. And she was in tears. And the doctor said to me, if you don't stop drinking, this was Christmas Day. He said, And at this point, it was 2 days after Christmas, so my last drink had been Christmas Eve. And because I hadn't had the drink Christmas morning, I was, you know, this is why what happened, I guess. And this guy said to me 2 days later, if you don't stop drinking, you'll die. You're going to die. He said, your liver function is, we can't even register it. It's so shit. And your body's shutting down. We need to discharge you. We're sending you home with tablets. You need to go to your doctor. And you need to take this letter. And that scared the living shit out of me. That was my rock bottom. And that was Christmas Day 11 and a half years ago. and I was just heading into my 40th birthday. And I went home and I went to my doctor and they gave me some Librium, 2 days worth. And I sat in the chair in the living room at home in the coat that I you know, my partner was with me, and he's still with me, he's not an addict. I sat in the chair for 3 days. I didn't fucking move. I didn't even take my coat off. I just sat for 3 days, curled up like a little ball. He kept putting cigarettes in my mouth when I wanted them and lighting them. I didn't even go to the bathroom. I didn't, you know, nothing happened. I just didn't move. And I got clean. And that's how I did it. And on the odd occasion, that, during those sort of 72 hours that I thought I was going to lose the plot, he fed me the Librium. And I rattled it, and it was living hell. You know, I don't have to tell any of you what a rattle or a cluck or whatever you want to call it is like. It was fucking horrible. And I went to the doctor every week to have my bloods done. My doctor was brilliant. I couldn't manage without her. And the skin started falling off my body. It was hideous. And she said, I'm quite alarmed because your liver function is coming back down to normal so fast that it's actually fucking dangerous. And we need to start you off on something else. And I started off with a pain in my toes, and for the next 6 weeks, it crept up my legs, through my knees, through every body, every part of my body, and it left my head, the top of my head, 6 weeks later, and it was excruciating pain. And then suddenly I started to feel alive again. And I remembered that someone had said to me about NA, and I had this knowledge of the internet. So I put the two together and I found NA online. And I went to every goddamn meeting that they had online. And back in the day, there weren't that many. But, you know, I was there sharing and listening. And even kind of rogue meetings that weren't recognised, I was in those too. I was just on it all the time. I couldn't get enough of it. And I clung to it. And, you know, I got myself a sponsor. I broke every rule in the book on that one. I got a guy who sponsored me, and within 9 months clean, I was doing service. And I was giving a tremendous amount back. And I went out to see my sponsor, and he lived with a woman. And it was great. We had a great time. And I carried on doing service for another year or more. And I went to see my sponsor again. At this point, I'd shared a lot of information with this guy. A lot of intimate information, the sort of thing you share with someone you trust. By this point, he'd moved on to wife number two, and when I got out there, I began to realise that not everything was as it should be. And to cut a long story short, I realised what the guy was. And it certainly never happened with me, but he was, I guess, what we call a 13-stepper. Preyed on vulnerable women. And I just realised that one day, sat in his house, and, you know, me and his now ex-wife, yet another one, are very good friends. And if she hadn't have been there, I dread to think what would have happened. But I came back, and I started sharing this shit with the guy that sat next to me right now. And I got rid of him as a sponsor, the other guy, and I had a lot of problems. You know, he threatened to blast my step four out into the wide world. He was going to ring up my partner and tell him what I'd said. And I, you know, I was just pushing two years clean, I guess, Steve, at this point. So still, and you know, suddenly I became quite vulnerable again. And I'm very grateful and fortunate that Steve, you know, stepped in as a man with hell of a lot of clean time and sorted this out. Because I think at that point I would have picked up. It was scary and it frightened me, and he knew how to frighten women, and that's how he made women do what he wanted to do. And I grabbed hold of Steve and said, you'll have to sponsor me. So I broke the rule again, another male sponsor. But you know, as a farmer, I've only ever worked with men, and it works for me, and it works for Steve. And we've been together a long time now. And I, you know, I threw myself into more and more service work. And I carried on working. I never stopped working. And that, you know, that wasn't the greatest thing I ever did. But I got stronger. I still suffered with my nerves. And after, well, I don't know, 4 years, 5 years of listening to people in NA saying, well, you know, just pray for them to go away and stuff like that, I'd had enough. And I went to see my doctor and she said, you know, you didn't get clean to fucking suffer. we're going to bang you on a low dose of paroxetine, and I've been on them ever since. And you know, my quality of life is amazing. And I did a lot of service, and you know, things alongside Steve and alongside another girl that's here with us today. And things, you know, started to not be so great there. So I always banged the internet and recovery drum. And the first time I came to this conference, I had a lot of arguments with people about the recovery online. You know, it's not the real deal. And I was, you know, I'm passionate about it. I really am. I have 11 and a half years clean thanks to online recovery. There's no two ways about that. I've only ever done two face-to-face meetings other than at conference, and they've both been in America. It's not possible where I live. It doesn't happen. And the lifestyle that I lead and the job that I do for a living, because we're all involved in farming again now, means that no matter how shit I feel and no matter what I need to do, the animals and everything that relies on me has to be looked after. There's no saying to Doc, well, I, you know, I'm not going to feed you tonight because I need to get to a fucking meeting. It just doesn't happen. It's as simple as that. Our window as agricultural contractors for making money is very short. We have to function around the grouse shooting season. Whether people like that or not is irrelevant. We're not that keen, but it's our big. It's what happens where we live, and it's where we earn money. So recovery, if it wasn't for online, I'd be dead. I wouldn't be sat here, and it's that simple. So Steve, you know, we were both a bit disgruntled, and Steve came up with this idea of setting up what we're sat talking on now, basically, and I was game on. And I sat and chaired quite a few meetings where there was just me in and me in. And that was it. And Christine, yeah, Christine was there too. And then there was me and Steve and Christine, and me and Steve and Christine and Joe Bloggs. And then Fred Bloggs came along, and then Edna Smith joined in, and one or two other people. And suddenly people are sat there saying, oh, thank God this is here, and thank God it's alive. And people started to come in like Jay, who, you know, a lot more impetus and a lot more ideas. By this point, I'd done 5 or 6 years of service nonstop. I was doing it every night of the week. And I needed a break, you know. I needed to go away and find out who I was and what else I'd got to offer to other people. And, you know, Dad's health concerns have got worse as the years have gone on again, bless him. So I stepped back a bit, and I do the accounts. I am your bookkeeper. And I keep hoping for the big drop from the bank, you know, someone to make a massive donation so I can go on that Caribbean cruise. And I'm sure those that have known me a while know I always say, let's go on the cruise when someone makes a big donation. But it's yet to happen for me, so I guess I'll just have to keep working away at it. And, you know, life, once I got clean, I worked my steps, which was a painful progress and for me. And several people have always, you know, a lot of people said to me, you know, you're the most obstinate cow we've ever met. And you really do recovery Deb's way, don't you? And I say, yeah, I do. And it's as simple as that, because I do what I need to do to stay clean. I picked up my toolbox. I listened to everything that everybody said to me. I looked at what I did for a living and what I wanted to do and what I wanted to achieve. And what I wanted to achieve was to be able to do everything that I used to do without alcohol. I didn't want to change my life. I didn't want to stop farming. I didn't want to do as rehab suggests, which sounds so damn easy. Go home, sell the house, get rid of the boyfriend, pack up farming, and move somewhere where there's meetings. Yeah, well, if only I could. It's not that simple. Farming is not 9 to 5. It's not 5 days a week. It's in your blood. You either want to do it or you absolutely fucking hate it, and it's as simple as that. It is the life soul of everything that runs through me. And I couldn't give that up. So I had to come up with the alternative, and you know, Steve and I, well, Steve came up with the alternative. I just came along for the ride. And it, for me, it's expanded. You know, I got involved. I'm now involved with lots of other projects. I learned so many lessons. You know, I was a very angry individual when I came here, the same as we all have been. And I learned to step, you know, I look at life now as in, when people are really angry, they're actually in a very tight circle. And I learned to step back out the circle, look in, weigh at what was going off, work out how I was going to deal with it calmly, and step back in and deal with it. One of my biggest gifts is being able to deal with issues, problems. That's what people come to me for. The shit hits the fan, they turn the fan in my direction. And invariably, instead of blowing a gasket like they are and screaming and shouting, I sit down and I figure out solutions. And, you know, people pay me to do this sort of thing. I'm pretty good at it. I've just had to sort out a load of shit last week. And I, you know, I thrive on it. I thrive on problems and dealing with solutions. And recently I've tried to create more of a work-life balance. I've given up some work, which astounds those that know me well. I spend a lot more time doing things around the house. I spend a lot more time gardening. I spend a lot more time with the dog, theoretically. I also actually spend a lot more time looking after Dad because he's in renal failure. But I also spend a lot more time helping other people. I think I shared on here only last week that I'm working with the Gamekeeper Welfare Trust. Because the state that shooting is in and agriculture is in, they're both very, very insular and lonely industries. And there's a lot of people in there struggling. And there's a lot of them using drugs and drinking, probably not to the excess that we have done. It's becoming a problem. And they don't know anything about people like us. They don't even know stuff like this exists. But they do know Debs is there. And they know that Debs seems to understand for some reason what they're going through and why they're feeling like they're feeling. And that they can share this, how they're feeling, with Debs. And she'll understand and she'll share something worthwhile back to them. And I'm getting more and more calls to speak to people like that. I've got trusted friends that are coming forward that are wanting to talk to me privately. And it's everything that NA has given me, all the tools, the ability to listen, the ability to take on board, the ability not to judge, everything. You know, all the tools that I took to keep me clean in the isolation that I'm in, I'm now bringing back out of the toolbox and trying to help other people. And I'm a firm believer. I remember saying to someone, they said, well, how does it fucking work? And I said, look, this was years ago. We're all in a big rowing boat. And it's a seriously large boat. And the more clean time you get, the more to the front of the boat you get. But when you get to the middle, towards the front of the boat, you have to pick up an oar and you have to start rowing. When you get in the back of the boat, you're a gibbering wreck. So you just sit there. We'll put a blanket around you. We'll give you a soft drink and we'll start telling you we'll start sharing with you how we did it, our experience, strength and hope. When you're feeling a bit better, you start moving towards the middle of the boat. When you're feeling even more better, you pick up an oar and then you repeat the process. So people get on the boat behind you and they keep moving forward as they get stronger. If I reach out my hand and help one person, and then they reach out their hand and help another person, we start to form a chain, and that's how we help each other. And my whole recovery has been based around that. I got rid of the dross in my life. I got rid of the fools, and I realised that if I wanted to stay clean, I just had to knuckle down and get on with it. I had to be the bull in the china shop. I had to not cry at everything that I stubbed my fucking toe on and that I banged my head on and that upset me and hurt me. I've dealt with more death. I mean, I have 3 dead children, for God's sake. I've dead aunts and uncles. I lost an aunt last year that was like a second mother to me. And I was saying, you know, Steve and I, the lady at Jim shared this morning, it was fantastic. It was very moving. But the lady that shared before her, you know, there was tears in the room. I stopped crying a long time ago because you become immune to it. You get used to dealing with it. And instead, I roll my sleeves up and say, okay, how can I help? What can we do? What can we do to try and make the last few months of your life easier, because that's what I've been doing for years now. And that's what makes me, I guess, what I appear to be, the cantankerous, hard-nosed. I know what I am. I'm a cantankerous, hard-nosed. What did you call me? Pragmatic little shit at the best of the times. But that's how I survive. And I've survived 11 and a half years doing it. I don't hang on by the skin of my teeth. And I haven't done for a long time. And that's, you know, that's what I give back to other people. I try and give what's been so freely given to me back to you guys. You guys have each other. We can help and support each other. But there's a lot of people out there that have no one. And I'm branching out and doing other things because I'm cantankerous little shit. And I go off in my own tangent. I could get up and scream here now that, you know, online rocks. It's what we need. And the people that are sort of saying, yeah, well, whatever, I just get hold of them and give them a good slap. But of course, we don't do that because that's not what we do in recovery. But that's how online, and that's how passionate I am about online, and I have been for years. But I'm very much now in the background with that and letting other people with more experience, strength and hope and clean time than me chair meetings and give their life stories and pass on to other people what they've been given so freely like I have. And I go off doing other stuff. You know, I run a social media site for people that drop in with all sorts of different diseases of addiction. And it's, you know, it's Steve and I have had some controversial conversations about this. But, you know, it works. People get clean. And that really is all that matters. You know, I'm working with the Gamekeepers Welfare Trust and sat talking to people. I don't encourage them to come into Narcotics Anonymous meetings or go to NA because they're not going to fucking do it. It's not what these people are. It's not because their life's so insular. And it strikes me that maybe we could look at setting up something completely different to what we've got now for these people. I don't know. But that's how I see things going forward. I have a great vision. And other people play out my vision now, and I'm quite happy with that because I'm at a time where I'm having to look after yet again sick people, and they're the people that are closest to me. It's always been great to be part of the Highlands and Islands of Group of NA. I can remember when it was just me and Steve. And I love listening to people's shares, you know. I get so much more out of it. I don't believe, how long have I been talking for now? Long enough. He's given me 5 minutes, you see, and he didn't even think I'd make it past the 5 minute post, and here I am rattling away. And you know, this is me. This is who I am. And my name's Debs, and I'm a very grateful recovering addict. And I'm really flattered that you've all taken the time to sit and listen to a share that's taken me 11 and a half years to deliver. Thank you very much, guys.